preaching after singing like that might be tough. I was like, that word, like, strength for today, like, okay, strength for my voice. That was amazing. It's so good to worship together. So good to worship together. This morning, we're carrying on in our More series, where we're looking at the fruit of the Spirit in our lives and how the Lord develops and grows the fruit of His Spirit within us. A lot of this talk of fruit over the last 6 weeks has reminded me of where I was born and where I've spent much of my life. Vernon, BC, Okanagan Valley, kind of fruit central for Western Canada. And in our backyard in Vernon, we had a cherry tree. And I remember one morning in my praying, this idea of fruit growing in our lives took on a whole new meaning for me. I was staring at these cherries each day as they were developing, cherry blossoms, beautiful, and then eventually cherries growing more and more. And I remember realizing and thinking how these cherries are doing nothing but hanging there. Doing nothing but just hanging there. They were relying on the health of the tree to nourish and develop and grow the cherry more and more. See, all fruit comes from the root. But the more the fruit hangs there, the more it abides, the more it hangs on the tree, or it grows healthier and healthier. And I remember one morning particularly where I was thinking, man, that cherry's just hanging there. And in a couple of weeks or a couple of days, that cherry, simply because it's hanging on the tree, is going to nourish me. And it brought home this whole idea that for us, as we hang with Jesus, as we linger with Him, as we abide with Jesus, He grows His fruit in us for our own nourishment, for our own flourishing. But as that happens, we're also used for the nourishment of the world. All fruit has a root. And the fruit of the Spirit grows within us by our ability to linger with Jesus. And God takes upon Himself the responsibility, the burden of responsibility to grow the fruit. So here's the good news. God has taken the responsibility to grow His fruit in your life. He does the work. But the flip side of that is, if fruit is not growing in our lives, we have to look in the mirror. If we're not more loving and kind and patient than we were 6 months ago, I think we would do well to examine, how are we hanging with Jesus? How are we abiding? Because this fruit is to grow more and more. Hence the series, More. Paul explains to us that the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things, there is no law. This weekend, we're looking at faithfulness. And it probably means exactly what you're thinking faithfulness means. It means to be loyal. It means to be courageous. It means to be utterly reliable and consistent, to stand and live with conviction and power. It means to be the same person everywhere that you are. And we all want to be faithful. We all want to live a life of faithfulness. You know, if we're married, we want to be faithful. We want our spouse to be faithful. One of the privileges is I get to do a lot of weddings, and I've never had a vow, the person say in it, I promise to most of the time be faithful. Oh, really? We want to be faithful. We want to live a life of faithfulness. We want to live courageously by our convictions and by our values. And yet we know that there are times when faithfulness is really hard. We know that sometimes it's a whole lot easier to cut corners, to compromise. We think no one will know. It's our secret. I won't get caught. We all have different areas where it's hard to be faithful, but we all have them. Maybe it's finances or work or home, thought life, attitudes, habits. We all have areas where we struggle to be faithful, but we want to be faithful. We value faithful. Perhaps we see most acutely the power of faithfulness when we look at what can happen when it's broken. When faithfulness is broken, it can lead to earth-shattering devastation. So more faithfulness in our lives? How? How does this happen? How can we be faithful in the good times? How can we be faithful in the hard times? How can we be faithful at all times? One of the things I've noticed in life is that it's a lot easier to pick out good and bad traits in other people before we see it in ourselves. Right? You always notice someone else's body odor before your own, right? You always pick out things in other people before you can see it in yourself, including greatness. And so for our time together this morning, what I want to do is I want us to examine the life of someone where we see a lot of faithfulness playing out. And I trust that as we do that, we will see how God grows faithfulness in our own lives. And so I want to use the story of Joseph this weekend. Joseph is one of the more well-known guys in the Bible. There's more space dedicated to Joseph in Genesis than anybody else. More than Adam, more than Noah, more than the big three, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Joseph of snazzy coat, Broadway fame is, you know, go, 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 Joseph, that guy. All right, we're going to look at Joseph. There's so much for us to learn from his life today. It's found, his story, in Genesis 37 through 50. I'll start reading the beginning and then do a summary of the rest, and we'll camp out in a few spots. I believe God has something special for all of us this morning. Genesis 37, starting with verse 2. This is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And he brought their father a bad report about them. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made an ornate robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. So, Joseph was born into privilege. He was born with favoritism all over him, with a ton of older brothers. What could go wrong? Turns out a lot. Joseph was given from his father this famous coat. It would have been luxurious. It was ornate. It would have been like long to the wrist and to the ankles. Picture like a really, really fancy house coat. That house coat was a sign that you don't need to work. Because nobody would work in a coat like that. So Joseph is the favorite. He's given this fancy jacket. And his dad is also saying, you don't have to work. You got a lot of brothers. Let them do it. To make matters worse, Joseph is out hanging with his brothers. And he starts to tattle on them. He starts to rat them out. His brothers already hated him. And then he starts to snitch. His brother's hatred grows and grows. They could not even speak a good word to him. He's not helping the situation at all. But then we come across the piece de resistance. It gets worse. One morning, Joseph had a dream. And he told his brothers all about it. So picture the scene. His brothers are down having breakfast, getting fed for their day of work. Joseph comes down with his fancy coat and he's like, hey guys, I had the craziest dream last night. You wouldn't believe it. I had this dream that every single one of you were going to bow to me. Isn't that amazing? So crazy. Hey Judah, can you pass the hummus? Okay. Joseph, dude. It gets worse. Later, Joseph has another dream. His brothers, probably on their way out the door, Joseph comes down flexing in his house coat. And he's like, hey guys, before you go to work and work hard all day in the desert heat, I had another dream. You're going to bow to me. All right, have a great day at work. I'm just going to be over here at Netflix or whatever. His brothers hated him. We read that later Joseph was going out to visit his brothers, probably walking with a little bit of swagger, strolling out to him, and his brothers see the fancy coat and they're like, there's that dreamer. Let's kill him. Let's get rid of him. And one brother, he's like, let's not kill him. Let's just throw him into a pit. So I throw him into a cistern. He's down there, he's screaming, he's crying out for help. While that's happening, the brothers see a caravan of gypsies out in the horizon, and they're like, why don't we just sell the guy? Let's just get rid of him and let's get some money for our troubles as opposed to let him rot in a cistern. So they sell Joseph to these gypsies. They take his fancy coat, they dip it in some goat's blood, and they tell their dad, Dad, Joseph, who we love, he's dead. Dad's obviously distraught. Brothers are like, got rid of that guy. Who's bowing down to who? We follow with Joseph, and he eventually gets sold to an Egyptian named Potiphar. Prominent guy with a lot of power. And in Genesis 39, we're told that the Lord was with Joseph. The Lord was with Joseph so much so that everything Joseph put himself to was blessed. Everything he did turned to gold. Joseph's out in the yard working on it. He sneezes and a garden appears, right? Everything Joseph does is blessed. The Lord's hand is all over him. The only thing Potiphar was responsible for was deciding off the menu what he wanted to eat. Joseph did everything. Things were going really, really well for him. Verse 7 is where I want to pick up the story. Genesis 39, verse 7. We read, now Joseph was well built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, come to bed with me. But he refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. One day, he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants were inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me. But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. Joseph had influence. Joseph had power. Joseph had status. He was a handsome guy. He was strong. After the complications of his brothers abandoning and lying and selling him, Joseph finally found himself settled and in a good time. Well, as is often the case in good times, temptation comes knocking. Potiphar's wife noticed and tried to seduce him. He refuses over and over and over again. We're told that Potiphar's wife was relentless. But not only did Joseph not give in to her, we read that he refused to even be around her. And God is giving us a picture here of how to save our lives and how faithfulness grows in our lives. In short, we are to run from unfaithfulness. Run from unfaithfulness. Whether it be a physical relationship outside of God's intention, or looking at images, or our thought life, or attitude, or cutting corners. We get the example from Joseph. Just run. While it might be embarrassing, Joseph ran off without clothes. Just run. And while fleeing sexual immorality isn't the only dimension of unfaithfulness, in today's world we know that this is the sharpest edge of the battle. Just run. Don't rationalize. Don't make excuses. Don't justify. Don't entertain. Don't contemplate. Just run. Kathleen Vohs, behavioral psychologist, she wrote that willpower is like gas in your car. When you resist something tempting, you use some up. The more you resist, the emptier your tank gets until you run out of gas. Every time you resist temptation, your willpower is being used. We are most vulnerable when we're continually using our willpower. So you might be like saying, no, not giving in, no, not giving in, no, not giving in, not doing it, not doing it, not doing it, over and over and over again. But every time you do that, you're draining the gas from the tank, and your ability to say no is getting lower and lower. So rather than stand and say, no, 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 just run. Every time you make a decision to resist something, you're using up the battery. It's why we're far more likely to make a compromising choice later in the day than first thing in the morning. Just run. Faithfulness in the good times is to refuse to even be in a compromising position. Best friend of mine said that sin is such a slippery slope, so just stay off the slide. Run. How does this happen? The secret's in verse 9. Joseph's response, he says to Potiphar's wife, "How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" Notice that Joseph doesn't say, "How could I sin against Potiphar, my boss?" Or, "How could I sin against you or me?" He says, "How could I sin against God?" Joseph lived his life with the perspective that everything is first and foremost towards God. Often we think of sin as a person-to-person issue, but before that, it's always against God. I remember when this became so clear in my life. I realized, and I was reflecting on, it is so much more difficult for me to confess sin to the people in my life than it is to confess sin to God. How is it that we are far more fearful of a broken human relationship than a broken connection with God? Our sin is first and foremost against Him. And Joseph's ability to run from unfaithfulness was enabled by understanding that this is against God. This isn't even about you, Potiphar's wife. This is about God. Our fruit has a root. And the fruit of faithfulness is rooted in the faithfulness of God. We just sang that beautiful hymn. It's based on Lamentations 3. In Lamentations 3, we read, "It is of the Lord's mercies that we're not consumed, because His compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is Thy faithfulness." Our faithfulness is only ever in response to the faithfulness of Jesus. And that's how Joseph lived his life. That was his perspective. "Great is Your faithfulness, therefore I'm going to be faithful in response." So Joseph does everything right here. And you would think things would go well for him, right? Faithfulness leads to favor, right? But we read that Potiphar's wife was so frustrated that Joseph refused her advances that she framed him. She says, "Look, this Hebrew came to make sport of me." And as a result, Joseph was thrown in jail for a long time. A long time. We don't know exactly, but it was a long time. We read that sometime later, while in jail, a cupbearer, the cupbearer to Pharaoh, and a baker were thrown into jail with Joseph. These two men had dreams. They were disturbed by them. They were confused by them. They're talking about these dreams, and Joseph's like, "I have a history with dreams. God gives interpretations." And he tells the cupbearer and the baker the interpretation to their dreams. He says, "Cupbearer, you're going to be reinstated. You're going to be right back. You're going to be back to hanging out with Pharaoh. Baker, your time on earth is coming to a close. Not as favorable." Well, the interpretations that God gave, understandably, both came to be true. As the cupbearer was leaving to be reinstated with Pharaoh, Joseph just says, "Hey, can you just remember me when you're out of here? Thanks." I was like, "Of course, I owe you one." Well, the cupbearer is out. He doesn't remember Joseph. Joseph's in jail for a lot longer, much longer. Eventually, Pharaoh had a dream. So Pharaoh has this dream. It's disturbing to him. It's problematic to him. He doesn't know what it means. He calls the mystics. He calls the wise men of Egypt. He says, "Can someone tell me what this dream means?" And no one's able to interpret it. And the cupbearer's like, "I know a guy. Oh, I forgot about him. But I do know a guy. His name's Joseph. He's in jail." Pharaoh's like, "Bring him to me." Joseph comes out saying, "Yeah, I know God. I know the God that gives dreams, and I know He can interpret it. What's your dream?" So Pharaoh tells him, and Joseph says, what this means, Pharaoh, is we're stepping into a season of plenty here at Egypt. There's going to be a lot. More than what we'd even probably be able to know what to do with. Tons. But after that, we're going to step into a season of famine and drought, unlike anything we have ever experienced or seen before. Pharaoh's like, well, what do we do? And Joseph's like, well, we should start planning. Create a system. In the plenty, let's store up so that we can last in the season of drought. Pharaoh's like, great, you're the guy. And Joseph finds himself as number two in the whole country. Everything is under his domain. And Joseph was enabled with wisdom from God to interpret the dream, but also to set up systems and structures that not only saved Egypt, but they had so much that the entire surrounding nations would come to him, including Canaan. And spoiler alert, his brothers come. And they bow down to Joseph begging for food because of the famine had been so severe. Dream come true. The nine chapters where that all happens, it's beautiful, it's stunning. Joseph pulls some pranks. There's some great moments. It's emotional. It's grace-filled. There's a whole lot there. I recommend reading it. Before we jump to the conclusion, I want us to look at how do we be faithful in the hard times. See, it's hard to be faithful when things are going well. Proverbs talks about, Lord, give me this daily bread so that I don't have more than I know what to do with and forget that I need you. It's hard to be faithful in good times. But when things get tough is when I have seen in my life more people give up and lose their faith than any other time in life. The sheer number of well-known Christian celebrities and authors and songwriters over the last couple of weeks that have given up faith or lost their faith shows that we need to learn to develop a faithfulness in the hard times. We need to develop faithfulness to stand firm. I think it's important, and I think it's really important for us to notice that Joseph's faithfulness in the good times led him straight to prison. There's this idea that we, so many of us have adopted, and it's become such a common understanding that following Jesus is a guarantee that everything will go super smooth. I just don't know where that comes from. Sometimes living a life of faithfulness leads us straight into hard times, straight into the pit. But we need to learn how to have a faithfulness there. There's a beautiful phrase we see four times in Genesis 39. We should notice it. Four times we see the Lord was with Joseph. In verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered. In verse 3, we read, when his master saw that the Lord was with him. We think, yes, that makes sense. Joseph's in a good season. The Lord is with him. Check, check. That's how it goes. Things are good. God is there. But what about when we're betrayed? Lied to, slandered, sold, abandoned, treated unfairly, falsely imprisoned. See, all too often and all too easily, we start to doubt, we start to think that difficulty is a sign of the absence of God. We think that the storms indicate that God isn't faithful. But even in Joseph's storm, even in his hardships, in verse 21, we read that while Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. In verse 23, we read again, the Lord was with Joseph in the prison. Like bookends of Joseph's life, God's presence was there in the good times. God's presence was there in the hard times, in the prosperity and in the power, but he was also there in the season of despair. And when it's our turn in the cistern, our turn in the struggle, our turn in pain and suffering, we often wonder, God, where are you? And it's okay to ask that. There's permission. Psalms demonstrates it's totally appropriate to ask that question. But may we never lose sight that the Lord is with us. The Lord is with us in moments of joy and in moments of sorrow. Ultimately, though, the key to faithfulness growing in us is found in the last chapter of Joseph's story. Genesis 50, verse 20, we read this. You intended to harm me. He's saying this to his brothers who, you know, sold him and threw him in a cistern. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. I want to focus particularly on the word intended. See, to the Hebrew readers or the listeners, intended would have been understood as weaving together. And the pathway to faithfulness growing in us is understanding that God can weave everything together for good. Everything. There may be things in our lives that people have intended for evil. To destroy us, to take us down, to hurt us, to slander us, to persecute us. And God's saying, what people have weaved together in your story, I'm a better knitter. I can weave a different pattern. I can turn this for good. I can turn this not only for good, but for the saving of many lives. Maybe you've been weaving a pattern in your life, or maybe it's generational. Before you ever walked the earth, there's been a certain story being played out, and God's saying, I can weave a different and better story for you. I can weave a better story, and it's not only for your good, but I'm going to take that place of pain, I'm going to take that faulty weaving pattern, and I'm actually going to save other people through it. I want to take your story and weave a different one that's for your good. And I'm going to accomplish saving of many lives. So often we see these patterns in Joseph's lives, and I think it's good to notice, right at the very beginning, Joseph is thrown into a cistern and God saves him with the gypsies. Betrayed by his brothers, delivered by God. Betrayed by Potiphar, delivered by God, brought to a different position of power. And he's like, probably when he's in jail for the second time, he's like, I know how this story ends. I know how God can weave it. I don't know how, but I know how the story ends. You know, Joseph's given a dream as a teenager, made people hate him. But he learned to trust God's provision. He learned to trust God's dream. So when the cupbearer and the baker come in, he's like, yeah, God's proven faithful in this. He can give me an interpretation for you. Pharaoh needs interpretation. That's nothing for God. You know, he's betrayed from brothers, prominence in Potiphar. Betrayed by Potiphar, prominence in Egypt. Every season, every jail cell, every betrayal, every point of pain in Joseph's life was weaved for greater and greater good, so much so that he actually saved an entire nation of Egypt and the surrounding nations as well. And at the end of the story, Joseph can say, I know how it ends. I know the one that weaves a better story. I was tempted to call this sermon the story of three coats. Coats are a prominent theme in this story, right? At the beginning, Joseph is given a coat of many colors, a coat of favor and prominence. But we see that coat getting ripped off him and torn. And I think it shows that a false foundation built on an identity other than what God gives, God will allow it to graciously be stripped from us, so that we can know our standing under him with his favor and his identity as adopted sons and daughters. Later, he's given a coat from Potiphar, a coat of influence, a coat of power. And again, his coat was stripped from him, from Potiphar's wife. He ran off without his clothes. He was forgotten and betrayed by people he served. Joseph had his coat of power removed. He was left with nothing. But it prepared him for the ultimate position of power. And so sometimes God will allow certain coats or certain things in our lives that we think are for power so that he can actually give us something when we have the perspective of, I want to use this to save other people's lives. Trains us for it. And as I was thinking of all this coat talk, it reminded me of the most important coat in the Bible. The coat that belonged to Jesus. We read that when Jesus was being crucified, the soldiers put a robe on him, and then they tore it off. They took his clothes and they cut them, they divided them by lots, they just got rid of his clothes. Jesus was stripped of his coat, and therein he lost and gave up all of his privileges. All of his power, all of his comfort, all things were taken from him. He was stripped down and crucified on a cross. He was faithful to the very, very end. God rose him from the dead, and because of his faithfulness to the very end, because of his commitment to do all that he was called to do in obedience, because of his faithfulness, we are now enabled to stand firm. Everything has changed because of the faithfulness of Jesus. Everything has changed. Listen to these words in 2 Corinthians 1. We read that, "For no matter how many promises God has made, they are yes in Christ. And so through him, through Christ, the amen is spoken by us, and we say, let it be so, Lord, to the glory of God." Because of Jesus' faithfulness, every single promise that God has ever made is a yes in him. Every promise that God has ever made in Jesus is a yes. "Though your sins are red as scarlet, I will make them white as snow." Yes, because of Jesus. "Though you have a heart of stone, I will replace it and give you a heart of flesh." It's a yes in Jesus. "Are you weary and tired and burdened? Come to me, I will give you rest." It's a yes in Jesus. "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you, not to harm you, to give you a hope, to give you a future." It's a yes in Jesus. "Though you walk through the fires, you will not be burned." It's a yes in Jesus. "Though the waters rise over your head, you will not drown." It's a yes in Jesus. Every promise that God has ever made in Jesus is a yes. And we get to say, "Amen, Lord, let it be so." Every promise is a yes. Yes. We just get to hang with Jesus. He grows this in our lives. He grows faithfulness in us as we just hang with Jesus like a cherry. And we trust him to grow his fruit. And as we hang with Jesus, he grows us, he nourishes us, he helps us flourish. And as a result of that, we get to be used in the saving of many lives. And friends, there are so many people in our city and in our world that need to be saved. Most of our city, the thought of church didn't even cross their minds this morning. We get to hang with Jesus, trust him to grow his fruit in our lives. Say, "Lord, I'll go where you go. I will say what you say. I will be faithful in the hard. I'll be faithful in the good. I will live my life under your gracious rule, and you use me to accomplish what you want to do, the saving of many lives. Here I am. I will hang with you. Yes, the story has been hard, but Lord, I know how it ends, and you can weave it together to save people. So Lord, here I am. I'm hanging with you. I'm leaning on you." More faithfulness in our lives happens as we hang with Jesus. It happens in the good. It happens in the hard. It happens at all times. And as we do this, we get to see God save many lives. Maybe like Joseph, we can see a nation saved. We can see surrounding nations saved. Oh Lord, let it be so in our lives. May we hang with you. Do all that you want to do. We look to you. Every promise you have ever made, it's a yes. And now, Lord, as a response, we say to you, "Amen. Let it be so."